Become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/MovieGeeksUnite, Facebook at facebook.com/MovieGeeksUnited, YouTube at youtube.com/MovieGeeksUnited, or bookmark our website at MovieGeeksUnited.net. And you can also access our entire library of programs, including more than 600 filmmaker interviews, right here on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/MovieGeeksUnited. United, a packed show this evening. One of the best stand-up comedians currently working, certainly one of the most popular, Ron White, will be joining us in a little bit to talk about a new special he has out called A Little Unprofessional. And actor Matthew Lillard, you know and love him from movies like Scooby-Doo and The Descendants, and he's even in the new Clint Eastwood movie Trouble with the Curve. He has a new film out, actually his directorial debut, called Fat Kid Rules the World. He'll come on to tell us about that as well. But we also have lots and lots of movie talk. Subjects like, you know, Oscar choosing a new host, the Bond 50th anniversary, and some new movie reviews. But first, let me bring on our co-hosts, Dean and Jerry. Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up?
Hey.
This weekend, I think, like, Taken 2, is the third biggest October opening of all time.
What would be the other two, out of curiosity?
One of the Paranormals.
Uh-huh. Okay, that makes sense. All right.
And maybe a Saw. I'm not for sure. I didn't read the specifics.
Okay.
I'm just a headline guy, man.
Yeah, I know that. you know, your review, your tiny review, I agree with a good chunk of that. Did you use the word uninspired in your review, though? I don't remember.
Yeah.
Okay. I felt like I was watching like an episode of The Simpsons where it's like taken like 68 and it's just like, hey, we're going to just do it. It's so it just felt so run of the mill that it was really discouraging. I know people like it and everything, but to me, watching the films that Liam Neeson has made in between the first one and this one, I'm like, you guys could have really done something really incredible here. I mean, it just feels so stale. I hate to say it, but it really does.
Yeah, I mean, the fight action sequences are they're really lackluster. It almost felt like it was missing a sound effects track or something.
I mean,
everything just felt completely underwhelming.
I agree. I mean, but shockingly so. I don't know. See, this is my thing, and maybe you'll disagree with me. You know, ever since we saw this Indonesian film earlier this year, The Raid, Redemption, with the exception of The Bourne Legacy, most action films I've seen just pale in comparison. I would think, though, coming from this neo-French action genre that's been created, I guess, since the early 90s, that they would really try to do something like really revolutionary, at least make it exciting, at least.
Yeah.
There's something about having Liam Neeson fight the guy from Before the Rain. It's not exactly, you know, the Clash of the Titans here, no pun intended, but I mean, I think we need a better villain. I like that actor a lot, and he's been typecast ever since Before the Rain, but we just, make it somewhat of a challenge. I didn't, you know, he like knew everything, like where he's calling Maggie Grace and telling, you know, where he, you know, to with the map and everything. It's like, dude, I mean,
you know what? I'm telling you though, the thing with the map, my favorite part of the movie. It could be completely improbable.
Oh yeah.
But I said, oh well, that's pretty neat. I mean, that's a little bit of invention in the movie, you know. I mean, he kind of, to let people out there know that maybe haven't seen it, and it's not necessarily spoiling anything.
No, that's not a spoiler.
He kind of works with his daughter on the telephone. He's being held captive, and he helps her locate his whereabouts with a map and a marker and a pair of hand grenades.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. I thought, well, that's a little bit inspired.
Listen to me carefully, Kim. They have taken their mother and me. Kim, this is not a game.
Tell me what to do. I can do it.
Take the case. Take the map. You'll see a scale on the top in kilometers. Do you see it?
Yeah, I see it.
Draw a circle with the hotel in the center of it. Draw another circle with the market in the center. Now take one of those little cans, the ones with the pins on the top. I want you to go to the balcony with the grenade. Pull the pin out of it. Count to three so I can hear it. Then toss it as far as you can. Keep the phone on so I can hear the explosion.
They released it in France. It was a big hit, and they were thinking it would be direct to DVD here in America, but they said, let's give it a shot theatrically, and it became this major success. The movie could have easily been, had it starred anyone else, it would have been a direct to DVD. You could imagine Steven Seagal or one of the lesser kind of action figures.
Don the Dragon Wilson.
Yeah, anybody like that, like starring in that movie, and that's what that movie would have been. What made it unique was Liam Neeson.
Mm-hmm.
Playing that part. I mean,
right,
that elevated
right,
it. But we've seen Liam Neeson play that part now ever since that first Taken.
Yeah.
I mean, that's his stock and trade now. So the kind of the veneer of that has worn off by now.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, what do you do with the Taken sequel? I mean, you do more of the same. You just try to raise the stakes a little
bit.
I mean, that's what they did, but it seemed like, you're absolutely right, just so run-of-the-mill, and preposterous right down to the very ending of it.
Mm-hmm.
When she gets her driver's license after the driving test,
yeah,
and she steps out of the car, and the woman with the clipboard says, you did perfect, 100%. And I was like, she wasn't even wearing a seatbelt. I mean, another lazy point to that movie. It seems superficial, but I noticed it, you know.
Yeah, no. I think, you know, but he's made some, you know, since Taken, like The Gray or even Unknown, you know, that are actually good movies. But I don't know. I think you brought up another really good point, and that's the analogy to Charles Bronson. You know, there's a whole generation of people who start after Death Wish would never know that he was in a lot of older movies, really classic films, really great films. And I'm not saying – I think The Verse of Death Wish is great. Don't get me wrong. And I even think some of the films he made after that are pretty good, especially The Indian Runner or something along those lines. But, you know, that was a good analogy. There's going to be a whole generation of people watching who will not know that Liam Neeson did these other movies before Taken, really. They'll only know
well,
him as an
action hero. And the longer he goes on playing this type of character, he's going to start playing movies like The Evil That Men Do and – you know, the Assassination, wherever he's protecting the First Lady. Brought
oh, yeah, Assassination, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Those types of movies. I mean, you know. Jerry, did you notice they used two tracks from the soundtrack?
Yeah, and I was looking for it because when you said it, and it was just like, oh, really, guys? Really?
I mean, from the score.
From what?
They used Cliff Martinez's score from Drive.
Yeah, I mean,
in one of the action sequences.
They did.
Oh, really?
the choice of music is just odd to begin with. I mean, the kind of the pop songs that they put in, it's
only
just
Tarantino
odd.
Can really get away and do that kind of thing justice, really.
Yeah, yeah. And
yeah.
50 years from now.
Yeah.
I mean, use it like when it just hasn't come out last year.
Yeah,
you
know? I know. That was odd. That was incredibly
odd. Yeah, that's strange.
At least Tarantino uses more Cody from the 60s.
Yeah,
know?
I mean...
I bet you can see stuff like that happen a lot. You know, maybe it was used as like a test track or something like that, the music, and they said, hey, it works fine, let's buy the rights for it.
Hi, I'm Seth MacFarlane, and I've got some very, very big news. And I've invited my father over today because I want him to be the first to know. I have been asked to host the 85th Annual Academy Awards.
Wow.
Isn't that great?
That's... pretty amazing.
Isn't it? I'm overwhelmed with excitement.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah.
Big news.
Yeah.
Anyway, listen, I brought you these bathing suits, and I want you to have them. They don't fit me anymore, obviously.
I don't really need bathing suits.
Listen, they're beautiful bathing suits. They're barely used. Here.
I'm not...
Take them. I wore them only once, and I had on underwear underneath there, so... Nothing of importance ever touched the mess.
I've invited you here today to tell you I'm hosting the Oscars. This should be huge news to you.
Of course, it's wonderful news. But also the fact that you're getting almost brand new bathing suits is also good news. And I think a thank you is in order.
Fine. Thank you. Thank you for these. Wow. Three new bathing suits, or kind of new. I'll issue a press release.
Give me those. I'm going to give these to Billy Crystal.
Oscar, they chose their new host. And when I say new host, I mean, this is a new host to anything,
mm-hmm.
in that he hasn't hosted anything before, except Friar's Roasts.
Right, but I think, I applaud it for its audacity. It's bold. I don't know if it will work, but it's definitely outside the box thinking.
Well, let me ask you this. Why do you think they chose him?
Ted was so successful. Because he was good on Saturday Night Live.
How could they, you know, base their whole show on one fucking movie? I mean, I'm personally sort of outraged by the choice of Seth MacFarlane, because I don't think that he has, he's not a proven commodity. He's never hosted anything, like you said, there. I think one of the reasons they chose him is because, and I haven't seen these things, but apparently he's been a guest on certain other variety shows where he's sang and danced.
Well,
and,
on the SNL.
They did announce it after SNL, so
yeah.
I'm sure that was like the final tryout.
You're right, that's a thing. But he's a very, I actually think he's very likable. He's very personal. If you watch him on Real Time with Bill Maher, and very bright too, I may add. I think he can do it. Look, I mean, he's got to be better than the year they had Franco and Hathaway on. I mean, he's not going to go wander off on the Twitter. At least I don't think he's going to go wander off on Twitter while they're on the air. I applaud it for the outside the box thinking. I think it's fine. I'm not outraged at all. I mean. What, are we going to get Billy Crystal to come back, or are we going to put Whoopi Goldberg on again?
Yeah,
okay.
Why not?
I'd rather try something new. It can't hurt. I think it can't hurt. And if it does hurt, it won't be the first time they've messed up, okay? So
why not go to Ricky Gervais instead? Steal Ricky Gervais away from the
It would be – now, that
Golden
is
Globe.
A great choice. That is a
– But you know what?
He'd be a hypocrite, because I think he can't stand them. He thinks that's a whole bunch of phoniness, though.
Seth MacFarlane, actually, I think, and who knows what he'll ultimately turn out to do, these are my hopes for him. I think that he fits the mold because he's good at biting humor, which is,
mm-hmm.
would be the polar opposite of what Billy Crystal did last year, which was the tired humor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he's also a showman. I mean, he's really like a song and dance man. So he fits the mold in that respect, too.
Right.
And these are definite show people that are producing the Oscars this year. I mean, that's the sensibility they give to it.
Right.
So I think he can give them all of that. Best case scenario, I think he's a smart guy, and I don't think he's going to come on telling tampon jokes. You know, he's not going to come on telling, like, Family Guy-style offensive humor. I think he'll know where he is. He'll just do enough so that his zingers are memorable. That's my hope.
It's,
my, yeah.
yeah.
Well,
my second,
you're right,
my second point
I find Family Guy to be completely, like, reprehensible and horrible, and I hate it.
But
through
looking
through,
at it
every
from a ratings
thing.
Standpoint, and let me tell you this, if he can get that demographic that seems to be missing from
he's
the
not
Academy.
Gonna get that. he's never going to get that.
He might be right, but it's worth, hey, dude, it's worth a shot. I mean, you want people to watch this show. And
nobody under 30 except the hardcore movie fans is ever going to watch the show ever again. They
well,
hate
I mean,
it.
Don't get me wrong, Dean. Part of me agrees with you. Part of me agrees with you, but it can't hurt to try.
I think that, you know, my other major point is because, you know, our friend Tony, like, took to Facebook and said, I refuse to watch it because he finds Seth MacFarlane deplorable, too. And I said, you know, don't watch the first 5 minutes, because really, that's the only currency a host has, is that opening monologue. And then you get to the awards, and no matter how you do it, it's the same award show every time.
Yeah,
I mean,
it really
you
is.
You have
that's
a certain
true.
Amount of awards to give out, and the host is irrelevant to that process.
You're not, you know, obviously, you know, the Oscars isn't your bag, then, if you're really basing it on a host. I could say, I will never watch the Oscars again. Johnny Carson is dead. I have no interest in it, but of course I'm going to watch. I'm going
to
watch
Look,
it
they
year.
Gave it to, they gave the honorary Oscar or to somebody that named names during the McCarthy era.
That's right.
That I actually wanted to see that because
yes.
I wanted to see the reaction. That's what you call good television.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, I could have taken the moral ground and say, well, I'm picketing the Oscars. I'm just going to stay away from it this year. But, I mean, it's a show, and that's actually, no matter what the reaction, that would have been a highlight of the show. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree with you, Jamie. I agree with you 100% here.
I'll be personally just holding my nose and watching. I won't, you know, and I'll be glad to be proven wrong. Like, I'll be, like, happy to be proven wrong, you know.
Well,
it's really terrific,
you know,
and everything. That would be great.
Even you know this, Dean. I mean, all told, total, you'll probably get maybe 10, 12 minutes of the host
of
an Oscar telecast.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So
that's
true. That's of a three-hour show.
Three and a half, probably. I mean,
that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not going to keep me away from watching it. I'll still watch it anyway.
Yeah, I didn't have a strong reaction one way or the other. It's sort of just like, okay, all right, Seth MacFarlane, okay, next year, you know, next year will probably be, you know, maybe it will be Ricky Gervais, or maybe it will
Hell,
be.
Hell, I'd rather have Louis C.K. up there.
Oh yeah, well he's brilliant. I mean
he's brilliant. I would welcome that. But here's the thing, we said this. All right, when Jon Stewart, it doesn't matter who you get on there, they're almost either. This is such smug people. They don't. I sometimes think someone like Jon Stewart is too good for them. And I think we might say the same thing about Seth MacFarlane or Louis C.K. They may be just. I don't. They might not fit in with the thing. They really, at the end of the day, we want someone like Billy Crystal who's going to kiss our ass.
Well, here's the problem with this. I mean, because a host, you want someone on the outside of that community, because the ones on the inside might not be as critical. You know, they might be a little bit weary of being critical. But at the same time, I mean, people on the outside aren't necessarily ratings. Guarantees. I mean, because people have thrown out, you know, true movie stars that are capable of carrying a show. I'm not talking about Franco. You know, I'm talking about possibly people like Robin Williams or Tom Hanks or, you know, somebody that carries a movie star pedigree.
Mel Gibson. That would be an awesome show.
Would you not watch the Oscars if Mel Gibson hosted?
I would watch it. I would DVR it. I would burn it to DVR, to DVD, and sell it because I think it would be the. I think that would be incredible. I would just
look.
Oh
if they
God,
really want
classic.
Ratings, if they really want ratings for it, they'd get somebody like Mel Gibson.
Yeah, I agree.
I'd much rather watch the Mel Gibson hosted
Oscars. If they're all about the ratings, that's what you do.
I would be tuning in. I'd be making sure I got there 15 minutes early. All that stuff. You know. That's. There you go. Let's get Mel Gibson
to host
instead.
Because the audience will be like wall-to-wall Jews. I mean, there will be. That would be a great show. That's beautiful. Okay, let's get to our first guest segment tonight. Comedian Ron White. He's a very successful stand-up comedian. He travels more dates in the U.S. than any other comedian working today, I believe. And he has a brand new special. It's called A Little Unprofessional. He's made it available online. He's taken it directly to the fans. You can purchase it for $5. Watch this great, brand new 80 minutes of material. It's a great special, very, very funny. You can go to ronwhitespecial.com. And Mr. White has also been in several movies, and we talk about that, too, in this conversation. So here's Mr. White.
Jamie Duvall.
Hi, Mr. White. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, man. I'm doing well.
Let's talk about the special a little bit. It's being offered through your website, ronwhitespecial.com, and there are a variety of packages that you're offering, but your fans can see the brand-new 80-minute special for as little as $5 there.
Yeah, that's the one I expect them to get. And it's a way for me to, you know, I do business straight with my fans and cut out all the things that are expenses, you know, like packaging and the hard copy and then Walmart's cut, then Universal Music's cut, and you know, just it gets it in their hands, you know, for a third the price.
Right. I mean, it passes on the savings to them. But do you find that because you touch upon this a little bit in your special, that the industry is changing a bit, and we see it in music, too, that you really do have to consider different delivery options nowadays?
Yeah, you know, I don't know how much longer the hard copy CD's got, you know, but its days are numbered, I guarantee you that. But, you know, right now, Louis C.K. is the one that, kind of started messing with the business model, And then I just thought it made sense. And I had this special already in the can before, and I was just looking for something to do with it. I just didn't like the money I was being offered from Comedy Central or anybody. They wanted to buy it, but they didn't want to pay what I wanted to get for it. So I thought, well, why don't I just sell it directly to the fans? And so that's what we're doing.
We flew in from Los Angeles, and we're going through LAX and go through screening. And this guy's just losing his fucking mind because I guess he doesn't travel that much. He's not used to this equipment. And he's just going crazy. You know, you can have fun with that. You can do what I do. I take two Viagra and demand a pat down. What's that in your pants, Mr. White? I have no idea. You're going to need to pat that down. Pat it back up again. Give it a couple twists, see if it's hooked to anything. You might want to go wash your hands.
Tell me how long it takes you to kind of assemble an 80-minute act like A Little Unprofessional.
3 years. I write the jokes one at a time, and I replace them one at a time, so I never let my show get longer than about 80 minutes. So, when it starts to drift past that, I just take stuff out, but I'm always putting it in one joke at a time, so it always stays strong. And it takes about two or three years before every joke from the previous album is gone. And so, that's a lot of work goes into one of these things. And then I produce them myself and, you know, had to camera crew come out and shoot it, and so there's some pretty expensive things in there.
Yeah, well, when you release it in concert form for all to see, does that kind of make that act obsolete from that point on?
It doesn't. Well, yeah, the material's burned, I guess, and it depends. You know, if somebody saw me do it once, they'll respond to it exactly the same probably the next five times they see it live. But if somebody watches something a lot, you know, somebody buys this thing and then watches it over and over, like I used to do comedy albums. I've just played them over and over and over. I just love the sound of the laughter, I guess. But if they're going to do that, then, it would seem pretty tired to come see me live. So until it gets – and I filmed this about – 4 or 5 months ago, so the show's already different a little bit. But, if you plan on seeing me, if you have tickets to see me live in the very near future, just go see me live and then afterwards download it.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you talk about the show being different now than it was 5 months ago when this was first shot, because I mean, it's kind of like live theater, which is what you're doing, and you're constantly refining based upon, you know, what your audience responds to, I would think.
Yeah, well, if they don't respond to it, it doesn't stay in the show very long. That's for sure. Yeah, it is. It is more like a play than people realize. And you know, even bits that were on this that I'm still doing are, you know, now I've got these just great tags for them that I wish I would have had back when I put it on. So there, you know, there'll be subtle differences, and then, you know, within, you know, another 6 months, you'll have a big chunk of new stuff. So, you know, I tour a lot, and that's my main income. So, you know, I don't want to discourage people from coming to see the show. But,
No. I mean, you do play a lot of dates, and you were actually in my neck of the woods in Florida not too long ago, and I went to see you, and you were hysterical as always. But tell me about the playing all over the U.S. Do the different regions of the U.S., do they kind of respond differently? I mean, are you playing two different audiences, or is funny
universal?
No, they
respond to it exactly the same thing. Where it's a human condition that we're in, you know. If you got to get up and do something that you don't want to do, you have the same human condition as most of the people that live in this country. So they respond, they laugh at the same thing in Macon, Georgia, as they do in Seattle, Washington, and the exact same thing. It's a little different in Manhattan because their reality is so much different, and which is where I'm at right now, by the way. But when I play Radio City, it's great. But if I do little clubs, you know, around town, they're waiting for a subway joke. And I don't have any.
Yeah. Well, you talk a little bit about your humble beginnings in the new special, and it got me to thinking. You know, now you've met with this incredible success. I mean, you're living your dream. What was the biggest adjustment for you when success hit?
Well, number one, it was fun to be validated. You know, sometimes people just need to be validated. And, you know, after I'd been doing stand-up 16 years without a lot of brouhaha going on about it. And so then when it did hit, it was just fun. I mean, I'd wake up every day and think about it, and it would make me laugh that now all of a sudden I'm selling out theaters. My money just went up 50 times what it was. And so all of a sudden, you know, I can do whatever I want and go wherever I want, any style I want. That was just, you know, for somebody that was born in a little white clapboard home in a town with dirt streets to this day, you know, it's a once, you know, something that doesn't happen very often. And you know, anybody that's getting into comedy now, you know, you need to be resigned to do it as a hobby. And if that's fun enough, then you should keep doing it. But if you see guys like me or Foxworthy or Chris Rock or whoever, you know, if you think you're going to get there, you're not, for sure. If that's even a goal, it ain't gonna work.
Well, you had I'm sure that you felt that this was something that you couldn't do anything else. This was your passion in life.
Oh yeah, this is the first time I walked on stage. My brain's not normal, and I don't think a lot of comics' brains are normal. Mine's really not. It's very much functional. It's ADD. I have two learning disabilities, but my brain has really high end peaks, but I have these low end rattles that aren't very good at all. But as soon as I got on stage, I knew that this was home. That this is you know, this is what I was meant to do. And you know, they say you find it. Well, I found it at 29. That's when I started doing it. And that's 27 years that I've been doing stand up. Seems like yesterday.
Yeah, I think I read where you said that two great influences for you were Hicks and Kinison.
Well, Hicks more than Kinison. Kinison taught all comics something. He taught you that the crowd can genuinely not like you and you can still make them laugh, which was a big step, because before you had Don Rickles, but that was pretend stuff. You know, they can genuinely hate you, and you can still control their, you know, how they respond. And so I think that influenced Hicks quite a bit, and because Hicks came up as a very, very young comic around Kennison in Houston. Hicks influenced me more because of my, you know, I suppose because my style is just like his. I'm not near as good a writer or comic, but, you know, I do conversational, you know, first person stuff. So, so that's, you know, that, I would say that's my biggest single influence, but I'm sure I was influenced by everybody because I'm, you know, I just bought all those albums when I was a kid and from the 60s and 70s. And I just, you know, I had, Steve Martin stuff. I remember taking it all around town, just playing it for people. So I didn't been taking credit for how good it is, you know?
And, yeah. Well, people like Hicks and, you know, Carlin and, I mean, those are real. I mean, they really kind of weren't afraid to step over the line. I mean, if a line even existed for them, there was a dangerous element to their comedy. I mean, is that something that you like to incorporate, that element?
Oh, you know, I don't think I'm as dark and twisted as Carlin or Hicks, and which is fine. That's okay. My comedy is different, and but I, you know, I don't do anything except for the sake of you know, the show. My only goal is to make you laugh, but not just to make you laugh, but make you laugh as hard as you can laugh, and for as long as you can laugh. So everything in my show is just geared towards that. And Hicks wasn't that way. He wanted to make you think. He wanted to make a point, and I haven't made a point in 25 years.
Well, I think that we laugh at your act because we relate to everything you say. So I mean that's the point. You're telling stories that we can all relate to.
Well, you know, that when you start dealing in the truth, it has a ring to it, like they say. You know, it has a ring of truth. You can tell it's true, and so it's. I think that's maybe why I relate to the fans so well, and because I, you know, I try to just be me. I mean, when I'm on stage, I try to be me. I try to, when I come off stage, I'm the same person. I don't have a persona, so I really do drink and smoke, so and cuss. So it's not a. I mean, that is my act, but it's when I try to just be true to my nature, and that's probably the. Only common denominator of all comics that have been hugely successful is they were true to their nature. That's, you know, whether it was Kennison or Hicks or Pryor or Cosby or Foxworthy or whoever.
Yeah.
You know, that's who they are. And, you know, it's, you know, Foxworthy goes to church every Sunday and has a Bible thing. You know, that's who he is. He can do his act in a saloon or a church and it gets the same response, and that's just brilliant. I can't do it. They'd boo me right out of the church.
But you, I mean, you've shared the stage. You mentioned Mr. Foxworthy. I mean, you shared the stage with other great comedians, and so I would imagine that there's a great sense of camaraderie between you and your colleagues, but is there also a sense of competition amongst you?
Not at all. You know, not at all. I've always been thrilled with anybody's success in comedy, and always. And you know, I watched Jeff blow up right next to me, and I even when that happened, I didn't think it would ever happen to me. But I just cheered Jeff on. You know, I thought it was fantastic, and I really don't. I know comedy at this level is not very competitive. I mean, I don't think so. I don't feel. I mean, Larry the Cable Guy always did twice the business I did. I mean, he was huge. But I was doing great business. He was just doing more, and I applauded it. I'm like, great, dude, way to go, keep going. You know, and he was pulling in $30 million a year for a while, and
wow.
So I certainly wasn't doing that.
But you, if you share a stage with those guys as you did with the Blue Collar Tour. I mean, you could see one of them go up and absolutely kill. I mean, that has to raise the stakes for you when it's your time.
Oh yeah. No, you want to bring it too.
Yeah.
And everybody did. It was you know, Jeff's job was the hardest because he had to follow all three of us, and he did it every night with ease. And so, but yeah, no, we weren't setting each other up. We were we tried to dig a hole. That's true, but you know, but it couldn't be done. Number one, I can't bury anybody in 10 minutes, and that's all I did for the most of that tour was 10 minutes up front, and then Dan would do 10 minutes, then Bill would do 35, and Jeff would do 50. And
wow.
So it's really hard to bury somebody in 10 minutes. And I never did it. You know, can't bury Larry the Cable Guy anyway, or Bill. Bill's just a fine comedian. And Foxworthy, you know, he's the probably the most prolific writer in comedy. I mean, I know he's sold more albums than Pryor and Cosby combined.
I want to ask you about your movie work, because you've actually appeared in a few movies.
Yeah.
And including Billy Bob's latest, right? You're in that one.
Yeah, that's the one I'm proud of. Sex and the City 2, I was in for 3 minutes, and one of the worst movies ever. And to me, you know, and right. I'm not saying the chicks didn't dig it. They may have, but I said right when we went through the debut of the thing at Radio City Music Hall, which is about half a block from where I am right now. And I headlined their room, so by myself. And so they had the premiere there, and it was just awful. They had Diet Coke and stale popcorn. We were in the theater for 2 hours because they said the red carpet was at 6. But this is a movie thing, so I'm not on movie people's radar at all. So Margot, my wife, who's one of the best singers in the world, and I'm one of the top comics. We walked through the red carpet, and hardly anybody took a picture of there. And nobody else showed up at 6, which is what time, because they know that it's not 6. So we just walked through it and went in and sat down, got our Diet Coke and stale popcorn, and thought, well, it'll probably start in a half an hour. Started 2 hours later, and I thought, well, it'll probably be an hour and a half long. No, it was 2 hours and 35 minutes long. And then everybody had to make a speech. And my part in this movie is really kind of towards the front. And after that came on, I asked Margo, I said, why don't we just go? And she goes, Ron, you can't go. They just said your name on stage. You're at Radio City Music Hall. You hush up. And we sat through it. And then they had a really good after party. But good Lord, that was long. The other one was Horrible Bosses, which is also a New Line Cinema movie. So same people. They just call. They know if it fits my touring schedule, and I like it, I'll do it, and cheap too, which is what they like. And then Billy Bob Thornton, I met him at a bar one night in Austin, Texas, we ended up just hitting it off, and he told me that he was writing a movie, and he's going to write a part for me in it. And I said okay. And about a year later, I guess, or I don't know, 8 months later, he called and he said, "Hey man, that script is written. You want to look at it?" Wow, that's weird. Because most people in Hollywood, they'll tell you they're going to do something, they don't ever do it. And Billy just didn't make a big promise. He just said he was going to do it, and he did it. And so he wrote this part for me. I play this 2-time Pro Bowler from Atlanta that has 6 car dealerships, new and used, and can't quit talking about himself. And it's a wonderful role, and you know, it's a great cast too. It's got Robert Duvall, John Hurt, Kevin Bacon, Robert Patrick.
It's got tons of great people in it. So that's a good prestige project to be part of.
Yeah.
Okay, that was Ron White. The special is called A Little Unprofessional. It is available now at ronwhitespecial.com for $5. Okay, Dean, you actually wanted to bring up a topic.
You know, I just recently on Film Wikibility, I did a list of the 100 greatest features, or the 101 greatest features and 10 shorts, the 10 greatest shorts that are directed by women. And it's so funny because you know, when I look over the list of all these movies, the one thing that I find that links them all together is that there are very few big huge, bloated epics or anything like that, with the exception of maybe Catherine Bigelow or Julie Taymor and, you know, Leni Riefenstahl. There are not too many, you know, huge stories being told. They're more intimate stories, and I think that's possibly because, you know, as I say in the article, I think that's possibly because, you know, there's a sense that female directors can't handle stories that are really big, because they have to control huge union crews that are mostly men, and I think that there's a sense that they can't really control crews, you know, as well as men can.
So is that an unfair assessment, you would say?
I would say so, but I mean, it's been largely untested, really. I mean,
yeah.
it's really something that you know, has only been tested, like I said, through really Taymor and Bigelow, really.
Do you think that women typically are even interested in telling those kinds of stories?
I don't know. I just said they haven't gotten a chance. I mean, you know, there's never – how come Catherine Bigelow wasn't, you know, thought of to direct any kind of, you know, superhero movies or anything like that? I mean, how come somebody like, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, Jane Campion. Why can't she direct
Bigelow
something like Atonement or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right. Well,
I don't know. It's interesting. I'd like to see what happens with Kelly Reichardt in the future, you know, with something like Meek's Cutoff, you know. I think that she could do something that was,
right.
Not, it wasn't a huge cast, but it was a difficult movie. They had to go out in the middle of nowhere, and they were on a extremely low budget. And I think that it showed that she could do something that was possibly, that seems a little bit bigger than just, you know, and I like those little small movies that a lot of women do, you know. I like those tiny movies that are just about people, and that's it, you know, or great documentaries like, you know, Barbara Kopple's Harlan County, USA, or American Dream, or, you know, or Lynn Ramsey's movies, you know. And Lynn Ramsey could easily be somebody that could do something big, I think.
Yeah, Lynn,
you know,
or Lynn Shelton or Nicole Holofcener, or
I see Nicole Holofcener as being somebody who's just going to stay in that wheelhouse, like, for her entire career. She just seems like she's that sort of Woody Allen-esque director.
Right.
I mean, you look at sort of Walking and Talking and Please Give and Friends with Money and Lovely and Amazing, all of which made my list, but they have such a specific voice that,
right,
I don't think that she would be somebody that. But I would like, I mean, you know, I don't know, it's an interesting, you know, Sofia Coppola could be somebody that could possibly do something, you know, do something big if she's given the chance. I mean,
right.
I have no doubt that any of these women can do bigger films. I mean,
right,
especially someone like Sofia Coppola that seems to thrive on exploring kind of different things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even though, if tonally, many of her movies feel the same.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that they necessarily want to. I mean, I wouldn't see it necessarily as a failure or a reflection on women that they aren't given the typically swinging dick movies.
Right.
Which a lot of the action movies are just that.
Exactly.
I mean, I really don't think most of them would have any interest whatsoever in that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, wouldn't it be interesting to see a movie or just see, I mean, like, for instance, you know, let's take Point Break, for example. I mean, who would have ever thought that Catherine Bigelow could do something like Point Break? I mean, that's not one of my favorite movies, but that movie has a huge cult following.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I mean, she's a special case. I mean, because she came out of the gate with Near Dark, didn't she?
Yeah.
Or The Loveless, which was with Willem Dafoe, and it was a motorcycle movie, you know.
I mean, she really thrives on the muscular movies.
Mm-hmm.
But she's taken that in a direction that, you know, almost making docu-thrillers in a way is what she's doing lately.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's interesting, but you know, one of the it's an interesting subject to bring up, and it would be, I think, you know, you might be right in saying, I even mentioned it in the article too, that this just may be the kinds of movies that women want to make. And then conversely, there's another effect, which is that these aren't necessarily the movies that are burning up the box office. Mm-hmm. So these kind of films. So therefore, there's that 1-2 punch of like, well, we want to make these movies, but they don't make a whole lot of money. So therefore, female directors really don't get anywhere. You know, so it's like.
Yeah.
I mean, so something's got to change. You know, there's got to be some sort of sense of change, or there's either got to be a sense of change in the female artists that we're talking about and them wanting to reach out and do different kinds of movies, maybe something that's completely out of their wheelhouse, or there has to be a certain sense of change up in the front office saying, you know, maybe we'll offer this to somebody who's completely unexpected here. Maybe we'll offer this new action movie to somebody like, you know, Sofia Coppola instead of some B-rate, you know, like the guy who did Taken 2 or whatever. You know, I mean,
yeah.
Certainly any one of these great directors, by the way, on this 101 movies list could have done a better job with Taken 2 than the guy that they got.
I mean, the 80s were the start of a certain period because you had Penny Marshall coming up, you had Seidelman, and you had Heckerling, right?
Right.
Or the early
mm-hmm.
90s, around that
right.
period of time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where are we today? I mean, do you think they opened the chapter for more women to come in?
Well, it certainly got, you know, from the 80s on into the 90s with people like Claire Denis and Lynn Ramsey, you know, Nicole Halston, whom we've mentioned, and also...
Mm-hmm.
Lisa Chudilenko, who did
The Kids Are All Right. And,
Kids Are All Right. And that, so all of that stuff is, you know, I mean, and Julie K. Moore, of course.
And there's also the woman who did The Savages in The Slums of Beverly Hills. I don't
remember
her name.
Tamara Davis.
Tamara
Davis.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and then, you know.
Tamara Davis is the one who did Bad Girls and Gun Crazy. I think Tamara Jenkins, I want to say, or
mm-hmm.
that sounds right. I don't know. I'll look it up. So,
what movie did you just
yeah.
bring up? Who are we talking about? Tamara Jenkins.
Yeah, I
was
think
it, did
the
she
Savages,
went Savages.
The Savages
yes.
and
yes.
Yeah, Tamara Jenkins did The Savages and The Slums of Beverly Hills.
So
yes.
There's two
Savages
Tamaras. There's two.
Well,
two
no, I think Tamara Davis is who you're thinking of, who did Bad Girls and Gun Crazy.
Well, look,
okay.
you have the director of doing Carrie now, the one that did Boys Don't Cry.
Yeah, Kimberly Pierce.
Kimberly, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
She's doing great work herself. I mean,
right,
an unexpected
is.
Genre, you know. That's.
Yeah, I mean, moving closer to today, like, you know, I mean, I already mentioned Kelly Reichardt. I think that she's, like, amongst all directors, like, a director absolutely to watch, like, whether she's female or male, like, she's
right.
She's,
what about Gillian Armstrong? Is she still making movies?
She's kind of petered out a little bit. She I don't see her.
I don't see her
don't
at
see
all.
Her,
but...
doing stuff as much, but we also have Miranda July, and the British film director Andrea Arnold, who's actually an Oscar winner. She won an Oscar for a short film she'd done in the mid 2000s, and she's since done a film called Fish Tank.
Fish Tank, and she
and,
did Red Road or something.
Well, she did Wuthering Heights. She did
that,
a new
that's
version
coming
of
out.
Wuthering
yeah,
Heights.
That's...
So, I mean, and then, you know, Claire Denis is still doing stuff. Jodie Foster is probably the only movie star that's actually made her way into directing as well, or at least female movie star. And then we've got, you know, some documentary filmmakers like Heidi Ewing and Rachel Grady, who did Jesus Camp, and
mm-hmm.
now have a new movie out called Detropia. It's about
right.
Yeah, they're coming on the show next week.
Yeah.
Actually. The Detroit
yeah, people. The ruin. So, you know, but that's about where it stops. You know,
Seidelman's
and,
coming on the show next week, too, or in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
So we got two female directors coming up soon.
And actually, we should also mention Lena Dunham, who, you
I mean,
know,
she's an unstoppable. I mean, she's beyond that, though. I mean, she's her. I mean, I actually think that Lena Dunham, it depends, I mean, with this memoir, the bidding on the memoir alone is something to talk about. But
Miranair.
3.5.
What's going on there? I haven't heard about that.
Oh, no. I mean, the bidding started at $1 million. I think it was $3.5 million or something. But on her book, she's written a book. But, I mean, you have Girls, which is second season. I'm very curious to see how that turns out. But whatever her follow-up to Tiny Furniture directing-wise, I mean, she's right now for the last year, she's really trying very hard. I am very curious what she's going to do because she's very young, but it's going to be very curious to see how she can make Girls branch out and last for more than, let's say, like 3 seasons. I'd be very curious to see if she can really pull that off because, you know, it's interesting. I think the reason that show works, not so much because of her, but because of the whole ensemble, because you have a lot of interesting characters. If it was just her, I don't think the show would have lasted more than a season. Mm-hmm. But I think it was really smart to make it, you know, follow a lot of different characters. I do think that that she is someone to watch, and she's very smart, and she's going to make – I think she has a couple of films in her.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, Catherine Hardwick is another one that's made blockbuster.
That's someone we really can't – she is someone – I mean, she made the first Twilight. She did 13 and – the Lords of Dogtown, and she made that one about Jesus Christ. So she's very popular.
Miranair, she's
interesting. You bring up, and she's one of these rarities. It's a foreign director who's crossed over into mainstream Hollywood and made big Hollywood movies. And
Mamie Letter. I mean, she hasn't made a movie in a while, I don't think, but she
not in a little
made,
while.
Yeah, she made The Peacemaker and
Deep
Impact.
Yeah,
I mean, she
was
entrusted to big studio movies that would typically go to male.
Right, and we don't hear her name. People do not mention her. It's very interesting because that's a very important person to bring up in this discussion.
Well, she started off as television. I'm wondering if she's doing television now.
What about Angelisa Holland? Did Europa, and... she's another one to bring up.
She's still doing movies. I mean,
yeah, she did the one
in
Darkness, which was superb. So there are a lot out there. It's very interesting, though. I think, let me ask you this, Dean. Does the foreign to American outnumber? It's higher.
Yeah, it's much
just
higher.
Just the name, all the names we're bringing up, I mean, yeah, it seems that way.
Yeah, and I mean, even somebody like Mia Hansen-Love, who did My First Love last year and did The Father of My Children.
The Father, that's a great
movie.
Superb movie.
So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of foreign directors out there, but that are female and getting plenty of work.
Right.
Plus, it could be just the nature of the game anyway. I mean, because I mean, Alison Anders.
That's the one.
She would be typical of the type of filmmaker that isn't interested in making the big, muscular action movies that are in vogue. And so, just like her male counterparts, I'm sure she goes through hell to try to get funding for her particular type of movie.
Well, I also don't want to just say muscular action movies. I don't want to just lump it into that. But also things like something like, you know, and I'm just bringing this up because it's a big epic but that involves a lot of people, but something like Lincoln or whatever, or something like Atonement you know, big Oscar-y movies. You know, the female directors don't get a chance to do those either.
You know who I really miss, actually? I really miss Rhonda Haynes.
She hasn't made anything in a while.
Children of a Lesser God and The Doctor. She's and I reached out to her years ago, and she was in England or something teaching. So she's not really even directing anymore, at least when I talked to her. Sally Potter is another filmmaker.
Another foreign filmmaker, a Canadian filmmaker, Sarah Polley.
Yeah, Sarah Polley is an actress.
Mm.
So, I mean, so there's still a lot of, I mean, I even at the film festival, going to the film festival just for the week that I went, I saw, you know, the Roman Polanski movie by Marina Zanovich. And so she's going to obviously continue in the documentary realm. And then also I saw the new film by Yassin Ustaglu from Turkey called Araf. And I thought that she's a real voice to you know, watch in the future, you know.
And you know, and Nancy Myers and Nora Ephron had great success, and you know, in the types of films that they made.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a, like an interesting thing to for the industry as a whole to ask themselves, like, why not get a female film director, not just to do, you know, something that's action-y. But although I think that would improve a lot of the action.
Yeah, you're right. You know, the unfortunate thing is that, I mean, those movies are risky to begin with.
Right.
But you see, if this could happen, if a female director does a Lincoln, and Lincoln flops, would the perception be, well, that's what we get for bringing on a female director?
I'm afraid that might be, you're right. I'm afraid that would happen.
So, but then if you don't take the chance, you know.
I mean, you never know. I'm certainly not saying that's right. But I guarantee you that perception might exist. And it's something that would never be thrown out for a man. Well, that's what you get for giving Lincoln to a man. You know, that's so true. Kind of risky about this kind of conversation, because you really have to confront sexism. And then, on the other hand, I mean, a lot of females that are directing, they don't like being the poster people for this argument. They said, "Look, I just want to do my job. You know, I'm not representing a cause here." And I'm frankly getting tired of asking about it. I'm not carrying the torch for all women. I don't feel that burden. No.
Yeah. Well, and that's fair enough too. But you know, we wouldn't even be having this conversation if over the entire history of movies, women had been given more of an opportunity in the director's chair. So it's like, I mean, there's plenty of, you know, the crazy thing about it is that there's plenty of female, throughout history, there's been plenty of female editors and producers, screenwriters, you know,
editing. They've made a mark in editing, certainly.
Yeah. And you would think at least, but there's been absolutely almost no. In fact, I only know of one female cinematographer, and that's Maurice Alberti, who did.
Yeah,
from,
there's Maurice. There's Ellen Kuras, who shot Summer of Sam and a few other movies. I mean, there are a couple out there, but I mean, because I went through them because we're going to do part two of a second part of our Art of Cinematography series, so. I started sending out requests, and there are a couple of females that I sent out to. But you're right.
But
I mean, that's definitely dominated.
There's never been one that's been nominated for an Oscar. So, and it's virtually the only category in the Oscars in which there hasn't ever been a female nominee. Even in special effects and sound, there've been female nominees, but not in cinematography, which I think is a telling detail because. Really, cinematography and the things, the level of support that's required for the art of cinematography, all the lighting people and the grips and so forth and so on, they really outnumber almost everybody, all of the other, you know, the art directors and all their support system on set, you know, they're really, and so I wonder if there's something there. It's like the cinematographers, which are mostly men, I've read this before that they generally undermine their female directors, you know. But then I've also read that cinematographers just generally undermine directors in general. that they they are the two, the director and the cinematographer are the two people who are most likely to clash during the filmmaking mm-hmm. process.
So, well, literally, I mean, they come to a head, I guess, and who literally calls the shots.
Right.
Yeah. So, I don't know. But I think there's something there, too, because, you know, all of that, you know, all of those lighting crews and so forth and the people that support the cinematographers, they're all men, you know. So
uh-huh.
are they going to take orders from a woman, you know, and take them gladly? That's a question.
Okay, our final interview segment for the night is actor Matthew Lillard. As an actor, you know him from Scooby-Doo and The Descendants and Trouble with a Curve and SLC Punk, right?
That's
SLC
a great
Punk.
Film.
Yeah.
I love that film.
Great movie.
Yeah.
He's terrific in that.
Yeah, he's really good. And actually, he's for the first time, he stepped behind the camera. He's making his feature directorial debut, adapting a well-loved young adult book called Fat Kid Rules the World. And it's a really good film. It's very funny, it's very endearing, and very sweet movie. It is now open in New York. It opens in L.A. on October 12th, and it's available on video on demand on October 25th.
Oh,
here
cool.
is Matthew.
This is Marcus. He's a guitar player.
We're actually in a band. We're punk rock, I guess.
Why did you tell my dad that we're going to be in a band?
Because we are. I'm going to play guitar. You're going to play the drums.
Oh, God.
Is that what you're wearing?
Dude.
Yeah.
I was stupid and didn't know what punk was. You showed it to me. You might want to reconsider your choice of friends.
Thank you, Mom. Women love musicians, man, especially drummers.
Hey, Isabel, would you be my girlfriend and have sex with me, like, as soon as possible?
Who wouldn't?
Why do we have to break into your house if you live here?
We need to go right now.
What?
Just sucking
I
your
am sucking in my gut.
I can't wait, man. I have to go right
Where
now.
Where are you
gonna
going?
Kick my butt.
Jamie.
Hi, Mr. Lillard. How are you, sir?
Don't ever call me mister. That's
I'm
terrible.
Sorry, it's,
that's
it's
all right.
Happened.
I mean, that just makes me sound so old and terrible.
I'm sorry to do that to you.
That's all right.
Well, the first question I have is, you're opening this weekend in New York and next weekend in L.A., and it'll be available on demand and various screenings across the country. This journey has taken the better part of 10 years for you to make this movie a reality. So
doesn't that sound exhausting?
It really does.
It sounds so exhausting.
It reaching this stage now where you're unveiling it to the world, do you feel relief or excitement, or is it bittersweet at all?
Oh, boy, I think it's all of those things, to be completely honest. I mean, first of all, it's exciting that I'm finally getting to talk about it and tell the world, like, hey, there's this killer little movie. Find it and love it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nice because more and more people are seeing it. I mean, I can count on my hands the amount of screenings we've had, public screenings, that, you know, it's just and every time you have one, you're like, oh, wow, see, people really like the movie.
Mm.
So it's exciting to get it out in the world, that's for sure. It's a little bittersweet because I feel like the movie deserves a bigger platform, and not to be, you know, not to toot your own horn, but I just think that people really enjoy the film. And so there's a part of me that makes it sad that, you know, that somebody didn't come along and swoop us up and get us out big and wide and let people find it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, it's definitely been an exciting ride, and it's changed my life.
Well, the movie speaks to such kind of universal themes. I think we've all felt at one time or another, like the lead character in this film, and I'm sure that was probably what drew you to it, that empathy.
There's no doubt, yeah. I mean, there's no, you know, I saw myself in that kid. I mean, you know, the movie's called Fat Kid Rules the World, but it's not about obesity or weight or size. It's really about being on the outside looking in and not feeling
like you belong. And I think that that's, you know, 95% of the people in the world experience through high school. You know, through being a kid, you're like, I just don't know who I am, and you're shifting and trying to find that thing. And that, yeah, for sure. I mean, look, I was that kid. I mean, I had a severe learning disability. I had glasses and braces, and I was overweight. And, you know, as I was floating through the world, I found acting, and it changed my life. And, you know, our hero finds punk rock music, and it definitely identified with the story, and that's what drew me to tell it.
Do you think that that's, you know, you spoke of the arc that your life took and how it mirrors this lead character. Do you think that that's the secret to finding something that you're passionate about, a place to belong in that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that when kids find that thing where adults go, hey, you're pretty good at that, I think that's a powerful moment.
Mm-hmm.
When the outside world validates what you like to do, I think that's a powerful moment, and I think that that can shift paradigms in people's lives.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you had, you recorded, if I'm not mistaken, you recorded the audio book for this particular story, and you fell in love with it in the process of that. I wanted to know what led to the decision that this has to be a film that I direct.
Well, everything that we're talking about, identifying with that kid and seeing myself in that kid and having an emotional experience while reading that book. Kelly Going, who wrote the book, is an incredibly talented author. And as I was reading it, I became more and more impassioned. And it just drove me. You know, the book and reading the book on tape, I mean, I became just in a trance, and it became a passionate kind of performance for me. And that kind of connection to the material and understanding that, you know, look, there's also the idea that I was in a movie called SLC Punk, and I know that the impact of that movie's had on kids, and I know that, you know, kid after kid has come up to me in my life and said, you know, that movie changed my life, and me and my friends watched that movie 20 times, and it's about making material and telling a story about disenfranchised little punk rock kids. And, you know, I know that the impact that kind of movie can have, and so that also led into why I wanted to tell that film. I think that somebody should be making movies for those kids.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know that directing is something that you feel very passionate about, and I know that you definitely want to explore more in the directing realm in your future. But you've been in so many films as an actor. Was there anything surprising to you when you stepped behind the lens for the first time to do this feature?
I think the surprising thing is how easily I fell into it, mm-hmm. and how quickly I felt at home. I mean, there's a part of me that expected learning curves or huge mistakes. And I definitely made mistakes. I made mistakes as a filmmaker, no doubt. But, I expected to struggle more. And that didn't really happen, to be honest. I mean, yeah, we had issues come up as an independent film that we had to adjust and overcome and adapt and make changes and on the fly, but all those things came really naturally to me. So in terms of the entire process, there wasn't something that caught me off guard.
Well, I always find it a strange kind of dynamic that you nurture this project for so many years, and you're finally able to get it before cameras, and the least amount of time you're afforded is the actual process of making it. And so along the way, I'm sure there are lots of compromises that occurred. When you look at the finished film now, how does it compare to what you had imagined in your mind all those years?
That's a great question. To be completely honest, it's hard to explain. I don't think about the other version of the movie that could have been. I don't think about the $20 million version of the movie it could have been. It's a little like I don't think about the woman I could have married. I married my wife, and I couldn't be happier. You know, I think that when you make choices in your life, very rarely in my life do I wonder what it could have been like on the other side. That's me. I'm not that guy. I'm not that guy that wonders about what could have been. I just kind of fall in love with what is. And so the filmmaker, I'm sure there's a $10 million version of the movie, but I didn't make it, so I never really think about it, to be honest. You know, it's funny. Last night, we had a big screening in New York and lots of reviewers. And I just wanted to see the first 5 minutes and see how it was playing. And, you know, I stuck around and watched the whole movie again. And I just fall in love with it, to be honest. And so there are definitely things I would change. There's definitely, I wish I had more days. In fact, I started thinking about the days we put together. And I'm like, wow, those days were crazy. And, you know, there's a couple scenes in the movie that I wish were different a little. But the imperfections of the movie make the movie what it is, and I'm sort of in love with it. So there's nothing I'd change.
I wouldn't change anything either. I mean, just as an observer of it from the outside. But it's interesting how at a certain point a movie takes on a life of its own. It becomes its own thing. It's out of your hands in a way.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's and that's the great thing about. About art, you know, not to get too lofty, but, you know, it's a piece of art. And I think that it's a collaborative effort. And if you can inspire people to give their best and you accept that, and you're like, you know, I mean, look, if I go to the wardrobe, the wardrobe woman and say, hey, here's my kernel of an idea. This is your world. Take and run with it and find inspiration. And get your rocks off, and make something that you're proud of. Then you're going to take your kernel, and it's only going to get better.
Yeah.
And of an idea, it's only going to grow. And so part of that means that, you know, you're giving away, you're inspiring other people's artistry, and you're giving away control. And so it becomes something bigger than you can ever possibly imagine. And the way it shifts and the way it grows. You're surprised all the time. I mean, in the performance, you're surprised all the time at what comes up. And I like that aspect of it a lot. I mean, the artistic kind of it takes a village to make something like this. That's the part of the filmmaking process I really loved.
Speaking of performances, I want to ask about your lead, actor Jacob. I mean, he's done a couple of other films, but what did you see from him that convinced you that this was the right kid?
Well, first of all, he's just beautiful. I mean, you put a camera on him, he's gorgeous. And I think that I like comedy. I mean, our movies, you know, it sounds so aloof and fancy pants the way I'm talking. The movie's funny, and I needed somebody that could handle and carry the emotional weight and also deliver comedy. And I think the great thing about him is that you fall in love with him, and then he breaks your heart, and then you're laughing 2 seconds later. And I think that that tone and that balance you can't get from somebody that doesn't have access to both sides of the emotional palette. If you can make people laugh, you know, you can definitely give people drama. I mean, you know, everyone has drama in their life, and everyone has access to that. But making people laugh is a gift. And, you know, I believe in that. And I think that he brings that into the part. And I think that's why he's so amazing in the role.
Well, speaking of which, before I let you go, I want to ask you one question about The Descendants. And you actually opened the door well to that, because someone that mixes the comedic with the dramatic so beautifully is Alexander Payne. And that was my favorite film the other year. And I thought you had the trickiest scene, the confrontation scene with Mr. Clooney. Could you tell me a little bit about what it was like to shoot that moment?
Well, it's, you know, you're in the hands of a great director. You're in the hands of if not the best filmmaker we have living today. Certainly in American cinema, I just think he's pretty divine. So it takes a lot of pressure off as an actor. All you have to do is be present and listen and, you know, take notes and trust implicitly what he says. You know, you're working with Clooney and you know you're in you know, that you're in a high pedigree project. I mean, you know, you're dealing with the best of the best.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and that feels good until you're ready to go to work, and you get to work, and you sit there, you hit your mark, you say a line, and you do the best you can, and you know, you take whatever Alexander says and you run with it. You know, look, I felt privileged to be a part of it. And I know Alexander's work. I mean, I've seen every movie he's ever done. So, you know, being there felt like, oh, I can't believe I made this cut. But look, you kind of get over the shock and awe of it pretty quickly and get to work. I mean,
right.
It's my job. I've been doing it for, whatever, 20, 30 years. And so, you know, I was excited just to get there and work and get a chance to work with the best. You know, George Clooney is the quintessential movie star and a fantastic actor and a great guy. And so, you know, it's fun to be there and fun to be in that kind of elevated air.
Okay, that was Matthew Lillard. Fat Kid Rules the World. You can see it on demand on October 25th. It's currently available in New York, and it'll open in L.A. on October 12th. So thank you, Matthew.
I love that title, by the way. Fat Kid Rules the World. Great, great title.
Yeah.
As a fat kid that wants to rule the world, I like that title.
I hear you, dude. I hear you. Okay. Did you see Daniel Craig host Saturday Night Live last night?
Yeah, not even he can save that show.
There was one funny part. They kind of did one of their pre-filmed segments of their made-up James Bond movies.
That was good.
James Bond girl that didn't make it. Like Penny Marshall was one of the Bond
girls. Dude, that Penny Marshall one was sick but funny, man.
And one of the one part of it that made me laugh out loud was one of the made-up titles for the Bond movie was Hippopotapussy. That's great. That's great. Anyway, it is as we all know, because we've been inundated with it, the Bond box set came out this week, and we've had lots of articles and popping up about the 50th anniversary of the James Bond film. So I thought we'd go through our list tonight, ranking the 22 James Bond movies using Entertainment Weekly's list.
Oh, okay. When did this list just come out with a new issue?
Yeah.
Okay, I haven't gotten that in a mail yet, okay.
From worst to best.
Okay.
So let me ask you guys, what do you think is the all-time worst Bond movie?
Oh, God.
Moonraker.
I'd have to say, it's like Moonraker, and I would have to say Moonraker just because it's just so, I mean, it's fun. That's ironically the first one I saw in the theater, but as you get older, it's one of the cheesiest ones.
It's completely silly.
But now, let me say this though. To Bond's credit, even Bond at its worst is so much better than a majority of action films. I'm sorry.
They follow
a specific formula. My dad said it best. So the best part of these movies is when they blow up everything at the end. So he's got a point there.
I love the tradition of Bond. I love opening with the over the top action sequence, then going into the song and the credit sequence, and then usually Bond movies die for me after they show the devices. You know, after M shows them the gadgets about, you know, a quarter of the way through it, usually they lull for me, and then
they
close well, you know.
But, yeah, no, they do, and I think you're absolutely right. But I actually think another one that, as time goes by, that may prove to be, is Quantum of Solace doesn't work after its bang-up opening. It wants to be so many things, and at the end of the day, it's really just an extended third act of the previous film.
I think they know that. I think that's what they're trying to make up for this new one.
Well, we'll see. I mean, you know, he has. You know, this film has the. And it looks good. Don't get me wrong. Everything leading up so far gives me an indication this is like a really good film. Hopefully, but it does have the. It has to really live up to all this hype being the 50th year and everything, and you have a film coming out and.
I think it'll be good. I mean, the people behind it are just extraordinary, from the technical to in front of the camera.
I think this is the most, let's be very honest, of all the directors they've had, they had some very good directors, but this is the most, like, how should you say it, original director.
That was the big curiosity, but then with Sam Mendes directing it. But then when you saw the trailer, I was surprised. I thought, this does look like a Bond movie. I mean, this looks like a kick-ass Bond movie. This doesn't look like Reservation Road or Revolutionary Road or whatever that movie was.
Yeah,
this doesn't take place in the kitchen, you know?
No, it looks good.
They agree with you guys. Their worst Bond movie ever is Moonraker.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
At 21, worst Bond movie, Die Another Day.
I agree with that so far. We're two for two.
Followed by Quantum of Solace.
Wow, this is, did we write, did they like this go into my, is it, did they do perform Inception and go into my mind to get this list?
Well, and you know, Daniel Craig, I mean, the makers of Quantum of Solace even admit, you know, that movie's a mess. We did not have a script when we had to start shooting, you know, so we weren't at the top of our game.
I actually think that film also makes another big mistake, though. They introduce, which is, I guess they wanted to try to make this, like, 21st century version of Spectre, Quantum, and then they don't do anything with it. It's sort of like, okay, we introduced this whole thing, and then they drop the ball, like, halfway through the movie. It's like, mm-hmm. Oh, forget about it.
They're number 19, The World Is Not Enough. You know, I don't remember much about The World Is Not Enough. It's not a good movie. But I will say that she has to be one of the worst Bond girls ever. I mean, Denise Richards is attractive.
I give you the unfortunate thing that The World Is Not Enough should have been one of the best Bond movies because that's the Bond family crest. The World Is Not Enough. That's what they're. That's in the Honor of Majesty's Secret Service. That's what we learned that in Latin, you know, The World Is Not Enough is the family motto when they're doing this thing for his to infiltrate Blofeld's organization. And you're like thinking, okay, you're giving it the film this title. Let's make it mean. Let's give the movie some weight. No such luck.
I mean, Denise Richards playing a nuclear scientist. I mean,
I'd better see Casey Lane as a nuclear scientist before Denise Richards.
And you are?
Mikhail Arkos, Russian Atomic Energy Department. Miss.
Dr. Jones. Christmas Jones. And don't make any jokes, I've heard them all.
They're number 18, You Only Live Twice.
This is good film. This is a must.
I enjoy that.
They remade this one so many times.
Yeah, they have.
Why You Love Me is a remake of this, and Never Say Never Again is, you know, it's really interesting. There's a whole thing. They're just trying to make another. They try to remake this all the time, but they wanted to make it with Pierce Brosnan or Timothy Dalton Warhead, like Len Dayton had written the screenplay. But You Only Live Twice is very interesting because Sean Connery left the franchise initially because the spoof, Casino Royale with Peter Sellers, grossed more money than this, and he was furious. He was just like, I can't believe the spoof made more than our movie.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is the best Bond song while we're taking a break from the list?
Goldfinger.
I would say Goldfinger, but I also might have to go with Louis Armstrong. We have all the time in the world.
I love that sequence. I love that sequence. But it's weird. It's not the Bond song that's front and center.
But that is
favorite. It disappears in the middle of the film.
Yeah.
Which is strange. And I like that. I like that they did something different to it.
Well, I mean, can we agree that, like, Shirley Bassey is the...
Is the go-to. She is the go-to Bond.
She's the ultimate Bond singer.
Yeah.
I also have to give props to Tom Jones doing Thunderball. Love that. And
I mean,
also,
just incorporate Thunderball in a song lyric is pretty
cool. That I always.
It takes Thunderball.
What about Anthony Newley? Anthony Newley's from Russia with Love.
Yeah.
That's interesting. That would never registers for me. I can never remember that song. Unfortunately.
No, it's a good one though. I like it.
I love Duran Duran's "A View to a Kill." Actually,
that's a great song.
And let's don't forget "Live and Let Die," which is That's the last Bond song to actually get nominated for the Oscar, I think. Or maybe not. It was "For Your Eyes Only." That was the last one.
That was a good one. That's another good one.
Yeah.
What do we think of Adele's Skyfall?
I still
haven't heard it yet, so
it's good. It's really trying. I mean, she's definitely trying to go for that Shirley Bassey kind of feel.
It sounds like a throwback. Yeah.
Yeah, and I like that. I think that was a smart move.
I
do too.
Pretty heavy on the sampling, though, isn't it? I mean, it's pretty heavy sampling, you know.
Well, they
the
maintain
theme.
A lot of the Bond themes.
Yeah, I mean, it's got it. You know, it's a Bond song when you hear it. I mean, you really.
There's
do.
A part of the melody that I don't like in the chorus, but I think it's a strongly performed
mm-hmm.
song. We'll play it at the end of the show.
Okay.
They're number 17, and keep in mind they're still giving it a B minus. As
okay.
A grade. Is the Living Daylights.
Yeah, I love all of those Timothy Dalton ones.
Yeah, both
Timothy Dalton was supposed to replace Connery when he was 24 years old, but he was deemed too young, ultimately.
Mm.
I think that his movies are really tough. They really tried to. I think they were really reacting to the sort of arch kind of humor that Roger Moore had brought into thing.
Interesting, License to Kill really is a precursor to what they're trying to do with Casino Royale with Daniel Craig. I mean, they really wanted to make a really tough, gritty character, and they did that with License to Kill, and unfortunately, it had the unfortunate to come out the summer of Batman and Lethal Weapon 2, and it died at the box office, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The number 16 is Diamonds Are Forever.
I love that. I love all the Connery ones, but I love that one.
You know, I watched that on the big screen over at the Film Forum a few years ago, and I thought I was just kind of in the mood to go to Film Forum, and they're playing Diamonds Are Forever, so I said, it's not one of my favorites, but I'll
go see
it anyway.
No, but Jimmy Dean is a trip.
And you know what?
Movie.
I had a really good time at it. I said, hey, this isn't so bad. This is actually pretty dang fun, you know, all the way through, all that moon stuff and everything.
Yeah.
I had a really good time at it.
He knew how to have fun with that towards the end. He really knew how to have fun with the character, I think.
Yes.
Their number 16 is The Man with the Golden Gun.
That would be one of the ones that I'd put lowest on the, even lower, because I find it difficult to get through that film.
It's
On Spike or TBS, where it's shown for 5 hours, I admit that. But now that's an interesting one, because that has a lot. That's already where the series is finding a lot of, you know, is starting to go into. We have to make this funny, and maybe too funny, because there's a lot of funny things. I mean, you have the sheriff that from Live and Let Die is there, and they have the car chase.
Problems with it.
But Dean, how could you not like that film? It stars none other than.
Yeah, really, man. I mean, it has a lot of great lines. And it goes to see Emma. Who would want me dead? Jealous husbands, tailors.
So, who would you choose as the best Bond villain?
Robert Shaw.
Oh, yeah, he was really good.
Robert Shaw and Telly Savalas and Donald Pleasant.
There you go.
And Donald Pleasant's very good in You Only Live Twice. And Charles Gray was great. I mean, everyone who played Blofeld in that early.
Kurt Probe, you know, I like Kurt Probe. I think he's pretty good.
He's excellent. And let's not forget, it's Joseph Wiseman, right, as Dr. No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's superb. I mean, he's so monstrous, those hands. I mean.
Do you know that one of the composers of the Bond theme, his name is Dick Flick?
That was my porn name for a long time.
That is not a made-up name. That is his name.
I realize that. I know that. That was my porn name.
Well, now, wait. He composed the theme along with Monty Norman?
Yeah. Dick Flick.
Dick Flick is my hero, man. Don't.
It was the two of them and John Barry. I mean, John Barry made it bigger. John Barry made it orchestral.
Mm-hmm.
Brought in all the bass and everything. Brass, not bass. Brought in all the fish. He brought in all the fish.
Yeah, he brought in all the fish, man. The salmon, the swordfish, the eels,
Okay, they're number 14, which I have to say, I might get criticized for it, but I can't help it. Tomorrow Never Dies is one of my favorite Bond movies. I like that movie. And it is one of the Bond movies that actually does not lag for me in the midsection.
Michelle Yeoh, great, and
paired well with Michelle Yeoh, yeah. Yeah.
No, but that, you know what, I actually do like that one. I just love the chase of the BMW, you know, the BMW
yes.
chase. I think that was one of my favorite gadgets from that Q gave him in that era. I love that with the cell phone and everything. Yeah, I thought that was very cool.
I like it.
Was that the one with Jonathan Pryce?
Yeah, he's like a Ted
yes.
Turner like character.
Yeah, that was the best of those Pierce Brosnan things. It's too bad. Pierce Brosnan, I really liked his Bond, but I never thought he got a really,
good movie.
The best of all of his movies, but I don't think that he really got one that was just a knock out of the park kind of great movie.
I always felt that was unfortunate because he was born to play the character. I mean, he got screwed over by NBC when he was supposed to play it originally. He couldn't get out of the Remington Steele contract, and this is the man who was meant to play James Bond.
I think so, too. I mean, he's a great Bond. And Tomorrow Never Dies was a big success, even though it did open the same day as Titanic, you know. But it was directed by Roger Spottiswood.
I like
great
the one
theme,
before that, too. Gold
a great
Mine.
Theme song from Sheryl Crow.
Yeah.
I like
Gold Mine a lot, too.
Let's see where it ranks here. They're number 13 as Live and Let Die.
Great boat chase.
Great boat chase, great theme, pretty good villain in Yaphet Kotto.
Oh, he's another one that's really good.
Yeah, and I like all that New Orleans stuff. But again, I find that I start cutting off with the Bond series when they get too funny. If they get too funny, too slapstick, like that stuff with Clifton James as the country sheriff or whatever.
But I love that.
I love that
line.
Switching off.
His first line is, "I've got me a regular Ben Hur cruising down the street here."
Okay, their number 12 is Dr. No.
Dr. Noah?
The original.
Yeah.
Wow, well, Dr. No is that? Okay, interesting, because that's a really solid movie. I mean, that's a really... just a
they
solid
give it a B.
But you feel that it's, you know, it's the first, so you feel like, you know, when you go back and, you know, you're already a Bond fan. Most people who go back and take a look at it, they're already a Bond fan from seeing the later films. And so that film doesn't really have doesn't have everything together.
Okay, you know, that's true. I mean, from that perspective, you're absolutely right. Cause now, I think all three of us probably remember the most, we watched James Bond, I think it may be true for Dean and I, really, on ABC, Sunday Night Movies. When they would have them. Remember, they would have them, and that was a big deal. This is before any cable and everything. So I remember the first one I watched in its entirety was You Only Live Twice on, I was in the first, this is like 76, I guess. That was the first one I remember in its entirety, and then I remember they had like Dr. No on and all these others. We watched them, but just remember it was incredible. I've never seen anything like it. It was just amazing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This one surprises me. They're number 11. As I remember, this movie was crucified when it came out. And the majority of the criticism had to do with, you know, Roger Moore is way too old now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's A View to a Kill.
Mm-hmm.
They give it a B+, a number 11.
But Christopher Walken is such a great villain.
That's probably why it's
he is
up
insane.
There.
And Grace
movie.
Jones is an interesting foe, or an interesting element in it, too.
Yeah.
Kind of exotic. And the
Tanya
opening sequence
Roberts,
on the Eiffel Tower.
Tanya Roberts is a nondescript Bond girl, ironically, though. That's the thing at the time, is like you're really caught off guard by what a nondescript Bond girl.
Well, when I think of You Two Kill, obviously the theme song.
Yeah, that's a big thing.
But also, the two big set pieces in the movie are pretty as grandiose as you can get. The Eiffel Tower in the beginning and the San Francisco Bridge at the end, the Golden Gate Bridge at the end. Yeah, that's pretty spectacular. The Golden Gate Bridge and the big blimp.
Yeah. No, those are very good. It's his swan song. I think that's another reason. But in hindsight, though, I think it's Walken's performance is so over. I mean, when he passes out the machine guns to the guys and they're killing all their own workers in the river, and he's just having a time of his life in that movie.
I think that explains why it's so high up.
Yeah.
Christopher Walken's performance in it.
Gentlemen, for centuries, alchemists tried to make gold from base metals.
Today, we make microchips from silicon.
Number 10 is License to Kill. They give it a B plus.
I have no problem with that. I might actually put it higher, depending on, you know, but I do think that's a really good one.
They're number nine, which they claim is one of the most woefully underappreciated Bond films, is Octopussy.
I agree with that completely.
It's a good film. It's another one that has a great opening, but it's got some great set pieces, and is Maude Adams the only girl actress
no.
to be in the series twice as different characters?
I think so.
Yes.
Is. And, you know, we speak about, God, here's another one. Louis Jordan is an awesome villain. And there's actually, I got to say, there's a real suspenseful moment in there when he has to disarm the bomb. That is a real edge of your seat moment. I have to give them props for that at the circuit.
This movie was released 4 months before Never Say Never Again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is odd. All Time High was the theme song on it, Rita Coolidge.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Involved a Fabergé egg. I mean, how could you not like it?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Number eight. Number eight is For Your Eyes Only.
I'm going to go out on a limb here. I think this is Roger Moore's best Bond movie.
Hmm. Well, they might too. They might think the same thing. I don't know yet.
It has a great line in it towards the end when he throws the ATAC, I think that's what it is, the ATAC device, before the Russian Walter Gotell shows up. And he goes, "That's detente, comrade. You don't get it. We don't get it."
You know what's interesting about Octopussy, actually, going back a little bit? I guess more they're doing contracting for the Bond thing. I guess they're trying to play hardball with him to come back. And so they started screen testing other people. One of the people they screen tested was James Brolin. And that screen test is actually on the Blu-ray of Octopussy.
I would love to see that.
Yeah, interesting.
How do you think he did in screen test? Do you think he would have made an interesting Bond?
Possibly.
Probably not. He's a little too American.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, yeah,
what about Brian Brown? There was a time when they were casting, you know, after Roger Moore, there was talk of Brian Brown, too.
Yeah, around FX or something like that. Mm-hmm.
But we like our Bond who drinks his martinis. We just don't want one that looks like an alcoholic.
There you go. Thank you.
We'll get into who we'd cast as Bond a little bit, which I think all three of us probably agree that there's only one real contender for it. But we'll get into that in a second.
Mm-hmm.
Number seven, I'm so sorry. The Spy Who Loved Me.
Now that's the best Roger Moore.
I like that one a lot, but I'd have to go with For Your Eyes Only over that. But
you
that is a fun
makes,
one. It's so
for
much
me,
fun.
What makes that one so great is its opulent sort of, you know, of course, in the entire history of Bond films, the word opulence in talking about its production design is like, well, that's what they are. They are all that way. But there's something about the look of Spy Who Loved Me. It really feels like they went like overboard.
Right.
Like they just. That Ken Adam production design in that is so fascinating to look at all the way through that it really feels like it raises the movie up. I mean, I think that's the thing that I like about it best.
Their number six is GoldenEye. I will say this about GoldenEye. There's one thing that I flat out don't like about it, and that's Eric Serra's score.
Really? Okay.
And that he only brings in the Bond theme for a split second in one scene with the tank.
That's the best. I think that's the best part of the movie, the tank chase.
Right.
I actually have to say, of all the Pierce Brosnans, that's my favorite of the four.
Yeah.
But like you guys said, he never got a movie totally fitting for him.
Martin Campbell is a more than competent action director. I mean, he seems
well
fitted.
Right. But that
good
Robbie,
theme song. Good
Robbie
theme song
Coltrane.
Written by Bono, performed by Tina Turner. It's a good theme song, I think.
Yeah.
Martin Campbell came back for their number 5, which is Casino Royale.
No, it definitely deserves to be. I might actually
put a
little higher.
Yeah, I might too.
Their number 4 is Thunderball.
Interesting. That's
surprising that's so as high.
Yeah. This is very curious. Go, keep going. Keep going now.
Okay, 3 more. At their number 3, they put a George Lazenby on Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Okay, this is my all-time favorite, Bob.
That would be the one that I think is the best as well.
I think this is a film, and I think everyone's read the interview with, I think it was in EW actually, was the interview. You know, he lived after this movie, he lived at home with his mom in Australia. You know, he never got the breaks he deserved. But he would have played it again. When I think of Bond, I think of this movie. And you know what? I'm not alone. You know whose favorite Bond movie this is?
Ian Fleming?
Christopher Nolan.
Mm.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
And that shows in Inception. Totally.
Oh, yeah, especially with all the snow stuff.
Yeah, I mean, he loves this movie. But no, I always felt this movie got a bum rap, and I thought this is the, and in hindsight, and in, you know, in retrospect, this is the this movie's gained so much stature as, like, really one of the best Bond films.
Is Lazenby still alive?
Yes.
Yeah, he is?
Oh, yeah, he's been in it, he's interviewed, you can friend him on Facebook, I think.
Oh, wow. I sent a request to Roger Moore, but I haven't sent one to Lazenby.
Oh, he would be a joy to talk to. Oh, my God, yeah.
Okay. This is the last movie that JFK ever saw before his assassination. It was screened at the White House on November 20th, 1963. Mm. 3 days before he was killed. Number 2, From Russia with Love.
I love this movie. Oh, it's so good. So good.
It's the most romantic of all of the Bond movies.
I would say this and Majesty's Secret Service would definitely be a contender. But it's that scene in the train between him and Robert Shaw. Just Robert Shaw is so menacing in the movie. And Sean Connery, everyone is in top form in this movie.
Yeah, it is. It's great.
Their number 1 James Bond movie.
Of course.
The lethal leading lady in the movie. They had to fight the MPAA to keep her character's name.
You're right.
Goldfinger.
Yes.
Yeah, it's the movie that set the standard for the whole series. I mean, it is the, no pun intended, the gold standard of James Bond. I mean.
Mm-hmm. It
the
is.
Gadgets, the girls, everything. The villains, it really set the stage for everything.
Yeah, I mean, the song, the credit sequence, everything is like all pistons are firing. I mean, the only reason that I would put On Her Majesty's Secret Service up above Goldfinger is because it actually does something different.
Mm-hmm.
It does something radically different with the series. But, that said, I don't have any problem with putting Goldfinger in number 1 either. Because,
yeah, neither do I.
It's also got the all-time great classic line from the Bond series, you know.
Do you expect me to talk? No, who is the Bond? I expect you to die!
It's got everything going for it. I mean, you really can't...
That's the ultimate, like, villain rejoinder, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so 2 questions to close off the show. 2 questions about James Bond. Now, the series has had many directors. Michael Apted, Terrence Young, John Glenn, who did Goldfinger? Who was the director of Goldfinger again?
Oh, that was a lot of,
I don't know off the top of my head.
Guy Hamilton.
Guy Hamilton did many of them, yeah. Martin Campbell, who would you choose to direct a Bond movie? Because many big-timer directors have wanted their shot at it.
Well, The obvious choices are, well, Tarantino was supposed to direct one. John Woo would be an awesome choice. Now, we had a great action director, Lee Tamori, direct Die Another Day, and it didn't go so well. So I'm
right.
hesitant. But there's a bigger problem here. You could have the Tarantinos, the Nolans, the Woos. They, unless the producers let these directors give them some breathing room,
sure.
It doesn't matter who directs it. You really
right.
have to, it's like when these, all right, how do I say it? It's like when you're a popular writer, but you have to write, like, or a James Bond novel or a Star Wars or a Star Trek novel, whatever, a popular franchise, you have to play by the rules, unfortunately. You can't.
Or even a better analogy, Jerry, would be like, okay, so you're a director, you know, like Keith Gordon or whatever.
Yeah.
Going on to do an episode of a show like The Killing or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Or a big director like Mike Figgis going on to do an episode of The Sopranos.
Exactly.
They can't put their personal stamp on an episode of The Sopranos
mm-hmm.
because really they have to work in conjunction with the creator of the show, and it's the creator of the show that has to keep the flavor of the series there and not have it overtaken by the director.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what you're facing here is
yeah, that's
a
big problem. And
yeah.
I don't know how you now, and in TV it kind of makes sense. Now, you know, we all remember Tarantino directed an episode of ER, and that people remember that because it had some of his trademarks in it.
CSI, yeah, yeah.
And you know, we remember these things. But in this, the Bond, the producers are very, you know, let's say, or not even say Tarantino or John Woo, let's say, you know, Scorsese has always wanted to direct a James Bond movie. But are you going to give these guys, these mavericks, are you going to let them do what they want, or do they have to play in the rules? And
well, I think in some cases, I mean, I think that some of the big-time directors, Spielberg has expressed interest, Christopher
mm-hmm.
Nolan has expressed it. In,
Nolan
expressed
would be
interest.
An awesome choice.
I think Nolan would be a nice choice, but and I think in those two cases, I mean, I think they are inherently respectful of the franchise. They want
right.
to be part of it because they like the franchise.
Right.
You know.
But there's also the other thing. I agree with you, you're absolutely right, especially with someone like Nolan. We would want them to, how should we say it, almost go outside the box.
Sure.
Almost.
Yeah.
There's a part of a set one, set two. But these are all great choices. It just depends what they can do, what they can bring to it.
Well, look, Sam Mendes is a heck of a filmmaker.
We'll see.
He is.
That's going to be
the mystery. But I do think that the Broccoli family, I guess they're still controlling the franchise.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that they're incredibly protective of what kind of voices come into the franchise. And
yeah.
I don't think that they would permit anybody to come in and really
take
go nuts with it.
Drastic.
Well, I think that's probably why they've gone to people like Sam Mendes and Michael Apted, because they're accomplished British directors, and yet they've never attempted something on this kind of a massive scale. So
yeah.
they'd just be focused on keeping their head above the water
mm-hmm.
and not necessarily, you know, making something
rocking
revolutionary.
The boat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Actors. So if Daniel Craig, I think he just signed on for two more Bonds. After his run is over, would it be time for Michael Fassbender to step up?
Oh, yes.
It would be time for him. There's the other one who played, the guy who plays Loki in The Avengers and Thor, Tom Hiddleston. There's a lot of people would love to see him play Bond. There's a whole, he has a huge fan base. Let me ask you this. Has the expiration set in for people like Clive Owen and Jason Statham?
No, I don't think so.
Is their time expired as choices? I mean, we don't really see them, either one of them, because at the time, before Daniel Craig, they were, especially Clive Owen, I mean, Clive Owen was such a shoo-in, they thought, in that he has a cameo in the Steve Martin Pink Panther film as a James Bond-like character.
Uh-huh.
So,
I don't think you're going to get a better choice than Michael Fassbender, unless you go to somebody like DJ Qualls.
he'd be an amazing Bond.
Now, there was talk.
That would be thinking outside the box right there.
There was talk, though, a couple months ago, or maybe a couple years ago, who is the actor, what's his name, who played in the British series Luther, but he was in Prometheus.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, I don't. And wasn't he also in The Wire? I don't know his name off the top of my head. It's slipping me. My Alzheimer's kicking in, so I don't know.
Is it time for a black James Bond?
That's who I'm talking about. That's
Idris Elba.
Yes, he would be awesome.
Yeah,
he would be
good.
Incredible.
Why not?
Interesting.
Why
Interesting.
Not a black James Bond?
Well, they talked about now, after License to Kill did so poorly, Cubby wanted to sell the rights. He wanted to get rid of it. He was so despondent, and no one would buy it from him. They're like, this is your thing. You have to keep this. You have to keep this. This is your thing, because there was talk of turning it into a TV series at one point in this hiatus they had between License to Kill and GoldenEye. There was it's interesting.
So let's close out the show. We'll be back midweek with Anne Heche and more movie talk. So let's close it out with Adele's Skyfall.
Sweet.
Song.
This will be my first listen to it. So.
it's a perfect introduction to it through a crappy telephone connection. That'll be good. That'll be good. The way
yes.
it was meant to be heard. Okay.
All right, good night,
everyone. Guys. Good night, guys.
See you later.